Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Deloitte India Webex. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Ms. Sapti Ghosh. Thank you, and over to you.
Thank you, Margaret. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Deloitte India's Webex. Hope you've all had a good start to the new year. Our topic today is titled U.S. Tax Reform, Impact on Global Mobility and Rewards Program. My name is Sapti Ghosh, your host for today's Webex. I'm a tax partner based in the Bangalore office. Together with my colleagues, Wendy Oxendine, Matthew Pova, Rekha, we will take you through today's topic on the U.S. tax reform. Wendy, Matthew, and Rekha are senior managers based out of our New York and San Jose offices. They all have extensive professional experience in the area of international assignment services. Before we head towards the discussions today, I'd like to bring to your attention a couple of points in relation to the Webex. Your queries will be addressed by our speakers during the Q&A session. We'll do our best to respond to your question as time permits. We've been hearing a lot about the widespread impact of the U.S. tax reform on company strategy and planning. Tax reform represents the most significant change in U.S. tax policy since 1986, and its impact on global mobility and rewards programs should not be overlooked. Given the footprint of Indian companies in the U.S. and the presence of a large number of employee moves to the U.S. and from the U.S., the U.S. tax reform has been under discussion at the CFO and head of tax levels in India, and it's a cause of concern. Companies are eager to understand the new law, how it would impact costs, changes required in compliance from an employer perspective, say payroll changes that need to be made, and employee perspectives, say changes in declarations that may be required, and in turn, how should companies be communicating with their employees and other stakeholders. Our speakers today will do a deep dive into the various changes that will have a bearing on a company's mobility program and call out some of the actions that need to be taken by corporates. In the next hour, we'll gain insights on planning for global mobility programs, planning for rewards, compensation and benefits programs, the impact on payroll operations and corporate tax deductions. With this background, I would now hand over to Wendy, who will take us through the key provisions. Over to you, Wendy.
Great. Thanks so much, Tapati. Hi, my name is Wendy Oxendine, and I'm a senior manager based in New York. And today I'm joined with my colleague Rekha Protatori from the San Jose office, who is going to help me present around the mobility programs. And then later we'll hand off to Matthew Pover, who will help us present on the rewards programs and various impacts of tax reform. So if we can start with the first slide here, one of the biggest changes that has come through that's been very highly marketed is really the fact that U.S. tax rates have decreased. So the top rate in the U.S. For individual income tax was initially 39.6%. That has now fallen to 37%. And the various brackets that are underneath have also adjusted. The thing that might be a little misleading, however, is that although the top tax rate has fallen, the brackets have changed significantly such that it may not necessarily translate to a lower tax rate. It's really dependent on an individual's personal facts and circumstances. Are they a married filing joint filer? Are they a separate filer, a single filer? Are they head of household? Things along those lines are really going to drive the impact of this quote-unquote reduced top tax rate. The other piece that's changed is around alternative minimum tax. So the U.S. has kind of a strange system in that there's a regular way of calculating tax, and then there's an alternative way of calculating tax. And ultimately, the alternative way of calculating tax is meant to hold a high-income taxpayer to a minimum rate of taxation of at least 28%. And so the idea here is that there were a lot of U.S. taxpayers that were falling in to this alternative method of taxation. And so with the changes, there's an increased exemption amount to keep more folks from falling into this alternative minimum tax, which theoretically means that a higher income earner would be able to pay a lower, a reduced rate of tax. So again, you know, the key takeaway here, I think, is that although the tax rates have fallen, what the impact truly means to an individual is really going to be pretty specific to their individual facts and circumstances. And then if we take that a step further, what does that really mean to a mobility program? Well, I think it means that we need to reevaluate hypothetical tax for your individuals who are tax equalized, because potentially the amount of hypothetical tax that's being collected by the company may decrease, especially if the effective rate of tax is going down for this individual. What it also means is that for any of your individuals who are on their own, so let's say that your population is very heavy with rotators going inbound into the U.S. or permanent transfers that are going into the U.S., what it means is that you may want to look at issuing some form of employee communication, because ultimately if these changes do translate to a higher income tax rate for individuals, then you don't want to be in a situation where the employee can come back to the company and say, but hey, this is not the deal that I agreed to when I took the assignment. You told me that my net was going to be approximately X, and now I am less in pocket than I would have been. What are you going to do about this for me? So I think, really the takeaways here are, you probably want to think about doing some modeling for your population. So what are the, for the tax equalized folks, what are the two or three scenarios that we most often see, and what does the change in tax rates really look like and really mean in those scenarios? And then you can take and extrapolate out from there as to what does this mean for my entire program. And then as well, communication to employees around, the potential impact that the change in the brackets and the various other changes that we're going to run through, what does that mean to them personally to ensure that you have set the expectation up front, how these changes could impact someone. So to make it a little more tangible, if we move to the next slide, you'll see that we've done a quick comparison here of what do the current rates look like and what do the new rates look like. And if you take a look at the 35% bracket under the single column, so if you see under the current law, you'll see that 35% bracket kicks in at $424,000 right now under the current law. But if you look at the new law, you'll see 35% kicks in for a single individual at only $200,001. So that's a pretty significant delta, meaning that under the new rules, a single individual is going to get into those higher tax brackets much more quickly than they would have under the old rules or under the old law. So although the highest bracket was 39.6% currently, the fact that it sounds great that everything has fallen now to 37%, so it sounds like everything has become lower, But in fact, for a single individual in that at that level of income, they're going to get to a 35% bracket more quickly, which means that they're likely going to have a higher effective rate of tax. Now, contrast that with married filing joint filers. If we look at that same line under married filing joint, you can see that under the current law, married filing joint filer would hit the 35% bracket at $424,000. Under the new law, they're going to hit 35% at $400,000. The delta there is not nearly as significant, which means that the effective rate of tax will likely not be impacted as significantly as it would be for a single filer. So that's why it's important to understand and to note that although it seems that the tax rates are falling, to really understand what that impact is going to be, it's going to be very dependent on individual facts and circumstances. So looking at, you know, what is the general trend within your population? Are they typically single individuals that are moving into the U.S.? Are they typically families that are going over on long-term assignment? That's going to be important to understand to really know what does this impact look like. If we move on to the next slide, we'll talk about now some personal exemptions.
Thank you, Randy. This is Rebecca from the TUVI. Hello, everybody. That's a great summary because the whole tax brackets change is we really need to evaluate the cost based on the mix of assignees the companies have. So that will drive into the cost and how do they model and actually identify or understand what's the impact of these changes. So in terms of taking further, this is one of the other important changes that will impact the companies, especially sending employees to the U.S. Under the current law, individual taxpayers are entitled to personal exemptions of $4,050 for each member of a household, phasing out at certain thresholds. However, under the new law, these personal exemptions are repealed, and this change will sunset in 2025. This is going to impact the personal tax obligations of your employees or assignees. And the repeal of the personal exemption may result in increased tax reimbursement and tax preparation costs for companies sending employees on business travel or assignments to the U.S., the reason being non-residents and dual status resident taxpayers were not entitled to a general standard deduction that we have. And without a personal exemption, a non-resident or a dual status resident who is coming to the U.S. would be taxable in the U.S. on the first dollar of their income earned in the U.S. So as a result, more individuals traveling to the U.S. would be required to file a tax return, and companies should consider the impact of any additional tax reimbursement and compliance costs on their global mobility program. And the next one here is the child tax credit. Current law allows for a $1,000 credit per child under age 17. This credit is phased out for certain taxpayers with the AGI threshold greater than 110K. However, on the new tax act, it expands this credit to allow up to $2,000 per child under age 17 and $500 per non-child dependent per family. And this credit is phased out for joint filers with with adjusted gross income of greater than 400K. So in addition, further to the credit, there's $1,400 of credit per qualifying child, which is refundable credit, which is a new thing. However, the refundable portion of the credit requires the taxpayer to provide a social security number for the child. So if a child is ineligible to receive the credit because the child does not have the SSN, and they may qualify for only up to $500 credit of non-refundable credit. So these changes are scheduled to sunset after 2025, but the observation here is the higher the AGI limits are, the gross income limits for the phase out will allow a greater number of taxpayers to avail themselves of the credit. So, however, the requirement of SSN may limit the overall benefit. So, and often the children of the people who are traveling to the U.S. may not be eligible for an SSN if they're going on a short term or a business travel, and you know, for some reason they're traveling with the family. So, with the repeal of personal exemptions and inability to claim the child tax credit without SSN, the biggest thing that we're seeing for the business travelers or short-term people is, do they really need to apply for an ITIN? So because the need will be significantly reduced, and the taxpayers or your employees may choose to forego this application for their children. So bottom line, we recommend companies to consider the overall impact that this change will have on the program costs for U.S. inbound assignees, and also weigh in the cost of obtaining ITINs against the potential tax benefit, because it's not easy to get an ITIN. The process is cumbersome. It's not easy to get certified copies and things like that. So earlier in the prior years, yes, we were always asking, you know, recommending the taxpayers or the employees to get the certified copies and go through the pain, because it makes sense. But now with the reduced benefit and with the requirement of SSN, then, you know, you may really want to think about, you know, how do we bring those changes into light in terms of what's applicable. So in addition to what Wendy said, so we are seeing companies interested in conducting some cost modeling to understand the impact of the cost of current programs and update their assignment cost accruals, and also, you know, consider looking at, you know, how the hypothetical tax withholding calculations are impacted because of these changes.
Great. Thanks, Rekha. So if we keep going, we'll keep moving through some other changes. So just to maybe take a step back to understand exactly how a U.S. income tax return works. So we kind of start at the top line with gross income, and then the next step would be to deduct any personal exemptions, which has now been repealed. The next step would have been to deduct any standard or itemized deduction. And after those two deductions, then you come down to your taxable income, which is what gets applied to all of the tax brackets. And so we know now that the personal exemptions have gone away. So that means in order to compensate for the personal exemptions going away, what happened is that the government decided to expand the amount of standard deduction that's available, and then correspondingly limit the number of itemized deductions that are available. So generally speaking, a taxpayer has to take either the standard deduction or itemized deductions. So if they choose to go with the standard deduction, that's now increased from roughly $8,000 for a single taxpayer up to $12,000, or from roughly $12,000 for a married taxpayer up to $24,000. So immediately, it's probably going to simplify the tax situation for a number of individuals, because you would have to have itemized deductions that exceed $12,000 or $24,000, depending on your filing status, to even want to move forward and look at what your itemized deductions are. So the first thing is that there was an increase in the standard deduction. The second piece is that within itemized deductions, the two most common things that are taken as itemized deductions are mortgage interest and deduction for state and local income taxes. Now, from a mortgage interest perspective, the amount that is available to be deducted has been reduced. Initially, you were able to take the mortgage interest that's associated with the first $1 million of indebtedness. That $1 million has now been reduced to $750,000. For any mortgages that are currently outstanding, they're grandfathered, but it's the $750,000 limitation applies to new mortgages that are taken out for both a primary and secondary residence. Now, depending on the makeup of your population, this may or may not have a significant impact. If most of the folks coming in, most of the folks in your population are rotators coming inbound to the U.S., it's unlikely that that they'll have a mortgage that's this significant. The one that I do think, though, that will have a substantial impact, irrespective of your population, is around state and local income taxes. And so, under the old rule, state and local income taxes, there is no specific limitation on this deduction. And so what that means is that a taxpayer may have been limited by their adjusted gross income, meaning that overall their itemized deductions were very high, and so they were scaled down. But at this point, the new tax reform says that they will only allow for up to $10,000 of deduction for state and local income taxes, which is a very significant limitation for any individuals that are going inbound to high tax state locations, which would essentially be New York and California. So if there's individuals that are going inbound into these locations, the highest tax rate in California is roughly 13%, and from a New York State and city perspective, the highest tax rate between the two will fall between 13 and 14%. So if you think about that, the higher the income earner, if they are paying 13% at the state and local level, they're used to being able to take that as a deduction on the federal return. So that could represent a $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 deduction, whereas now that's limited to $10,000. So if you think about, you know, what's the delta there, so, you know, let's say initially they were paying $60,000 in state tax, now that's limited to only 10. Take $50,000 at roughly 30 to 35%, that's going to translate into a material increase in their tax liability. So again, kind of going back to what are the individual specific facts and circumstances, the different moving parts are going to greatly increase what truly is the impact of this reform. The other piece, small piece that's worth noting is the fact that there's no deduction allowed for foreign property taxes anymore. You used to be able to claim a deduction for any property tax if the individual owned property outside of the United States. That is no longer applicable. So, I mean, I think, again, to kind of recap, what are the key takeaways here? One, what is the individual facts and circumstances that's really going to drive what's the true impact? And two, if you have a lot of assignees that are going inbound to states like California and New York, you should anticipate that there will be an impact for those individuals. If we move on to the next slide, now we're going to talk a little bit about moving expenses, which I think is a piece that will impact pretty much every population as well.
Thanks, Wendy. Yeah, I think the last biggest change on the tax side that we're talking today is, which impacts every global mobility program to a large extent, is the repeal of exclusion of qualified moving reimbursement. So under the current law, qualified moving expenses are deductible by taxpayers or employees or certain work-related moves. Aligned to this provision, qualified moving expenses paid by employer may be excluded from taxable income. So you don't have to report that as taxable wages on the W-2s for people who are moving to the U.S. However, under the new law, this deduction is repealed for moving expenses for individuals and the exclusion for qualifying moving expenses reimbursement paid by employers or companies. There's a small exception for members of armed forces generally not in the purview of where we work. But these changes are effective in 2018 and these will sunset after 2025. So hence the biggest consideration for companies currently assisting with moving expenses for domestic and international moves is the need to choose whether to continue to do so on an after-tax basis or determine whether the same level of benefit will be provided. Further, also decide if the tax obligation will be placed on the employee or if the company will continue to fund these costs via GRASA. So the international tax impacts should also be considered. Although moving costs will be taxable in the U.S., there may still be some preferential treatment in a foreign jurisdiction. So, yeah, there's a change in the U.S., however, wherever the other foreign jurisdiction employees are, the same current exemption may continue, where in most countries, at least for the short-term business travelers or, you know, short-term assignments, these kind of moving expenses are exempt from taxability. The other issue is, in order to execute this, companies need to be really prepared and update their payroll and benefit system accurately to reflect that these moving expenses are taxable wages starting in 2018. So if your payroll hasn't spoke to you about it, if your payroll hasn't like discussed about it, this is one topic you may want to raise internally and initiate those discussions saying, hey, you know, we heard this, how are we doing internally in the system? So that's something that we are constantly hearing from our clients and we are talking to clients about. So as you can see in the next steps highlighted here, companies should really start thinking about initiating those discussions and plan for updating the payroll and benefit system. You need to thinking about how do we, you know, design a process to collate those costs if there is nothing in place already, because if it's not taxable, maybe, you know, payroll was light in terms of how do we collect it, but now it makes a big difference. So you need to have that infrastructure to collect those costs and further, you know, quantify the cost impact of these change, you know, this change, and advise your business units, business partners, how it may impact their overall budgets and accruals for their, you know, business plans or, you know, mobility plans. And depending on, you know, once the company starts thinking about, you know, how do we pass on this tax cost, whether we keep that cost on our side or do we, you know, pass that additional tax cost to the employees, whatever it may be, communicating these changes to the employees is going to be key, and also reviewing these moving policies to determine, you know, what changes are required by the company is going to be very crucial. So definitely this is one area we are seeing a lot of questions being asked in this area and in terms of strategy, execution, and impact to the employees. Anything you want to add, Wendy?
Yeah, I think the only thing to add in terms of clarification here is around, I know one of the questions that comes up quite often is, the moving expense deduction, does this change anything for my short-term individuals that I may be paying a per diem to, or that, you know, if we have excess baggage cost for someone coming to the U.S. for a short-term period? And the answer is no. Those rules have not changed. So the U.S. has, when we refer to the moving expense cost, we're really referring to a long-term relocation where you're taking all of the items from the home location and you are shipping them to the United States. If someone is on a rotation that is 1 year or less, the U.S. has some what we call a quote-unquote away from home rules that mean that the individual is relocating temporarily. And as long as they qualify for this 1 year or less assignment, then expenses that are deemed to be ordinary and necessary related to that temporary assignment do continue to be non-taxable. So, you know, I think you really have to look to the substance of what is being shipped and moved. So, like I said, if it's a per diem, if it's excess baggage to pay, you know, for an extra bag or two on a flight, those are expenses that are ordinary and necessary associated with a temporary assignment. If someone is relocating their entire home, their dog, their horse, their cat, and they have to take the whole thing with them, then that's really going to fall into the bucket of moving expenses that we're talking about here, which historically were non-taxable and now are considered to be taxable benefits. So thinking about your philosophy and how your company manages moves, depending on the makeup of your population, is an important consideration at this point.
One quick question. Does this change in moving expense impact only inbound to the U.S., or would it impact outbound from the U.S. as well? So say a person is moving from U.S. to India, will he also be impacted given this change?
So he would be impacted on the move into the U.S. So generally speaking, moving expenses are attributed to the location to which you are moving. So if an individual is coming from India inbound to the U.S., those moving expenses associated with the move to the U.S. would be considered U.S. sourced and taxable in the U.S. When the individual relocates from the U.S. back to India, if those amounts are paid after the assignment, then that can be, so after the individual has broken residency from the United States, those amounts could be associated and attributed to India and considered foreign source from a U.S. perspective and not necessarily taxable. So taxable on the way in, but not necessarily on the way back. Now, the one caveat that I would say to that is that if it's a U.S. individual who is moving from the United States to India, so a U.S. citizen or a U.S. green card holder, then they're going to get caught on both sides because they continue to be taxable in their worldwide income by virtue of their immigration status or their citizenship. So it would be taxable in both directions for someone who is a U.S. person. Does that help, Tapati?
Yes, it does. Thanks, Wendy. Very clear. Good for planning.
And one interesting thing we're seeing, especially in the tech side, I'm coming from Silicon Valley, where there's so much focus on how do we, you know, the whole employee experience versus the costs and benefits to the program, right? So the moving expenses, companies have started thinking about, does it really make sense to give a cash allowance than actually do a moving expense, like reimbursing the moving expense, but there's always a defined employee experience versus the cost. So what we are seeing is there is this, you know, there's a shift in thinking of that what should be in the benefit package. Does it really matter for the employees to get a cash allowance since it's anyway taxable now, regardless how they use it, it's on their choice. Will they value that versus getting, you know, helping them with the actual move? So interesting things happening in terms of strategy shift, employee experience, especially considering moving expenses in the global mobility space.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we keep on moving, if we move on to the next slide, how do we make this tangible? What do all of these changes really mean? You know, let's put some numbers to it. So we put together an example here that's a U.S. citizen coming outbound to a foreign country. And we said that their filing status is married. Total compensation is $450,000. Hypothetical income, however, is $250,000. And the assignee moves on January 1st, 2018 with $35,000 of qualified moving expenses paid. So we tried to put some numbers to it to say, okay, what does that? How does the hypothetical tax that's collected from the employee change, and how does the overall cost to the company change? So if an individual is going from the U.S. to a high tax jurisdiction, meaning, you know, a location where the highest marginal rate is higher than the U.S.'s highest rate, we see that pre-reform in this scenario, the hypothetical tax that's due by the employee actually goes down. So at the $250,000 mark, a married individual, their effective tax rate goes down. So there's a $5,000 decrease in the hypothetical tax that's collected. Conversely, however, there is a $9,100 increase in the cost to the company. And the increase in the cost to the company is really driven by two factors. One, the fact that the company is collecting less HIPO, so there's less income coming in from the employee that's offsetting the tax cost. And two, the fact that you now have $35,000 of moving expenses that prior to the reform would not have been taxable, and now after the reform is taxable. So even if the overall effective rate has gone down, you still have these other two moving pieces that are creating an increased cost to the company. You see the same trend when an individual is moving from the U.S. to a lower tax country. So if you have any APAC responsibility, you know, think of a Hong Kong, which is where, you know, the highest tax rate is 15 to 17%, Hong Kong, Singapore, those locations. You still see that there's an overall increase in the cost to the company, but the overall increase is significantly less, and that's just a function of the foreign tax credit calculation. And so, you know, but the trend here, or the takeaway here, is there's a lot of moving parts. I wish I had a great answer to say, you know, this is definitely going to save you money, or this is definitely going to cost you more money. Unfortunately, it just is it's a little convoluted. But I think, again, the key takeaway is what do these changes really mean is really going to be dependent upon the makeup of your population, and some modeling is probably the best way to really figure that out.
And
with that,
go ahead. So at a high level, the tax cost from an India outbound perspective may also increase in certain cases. And while the impact, as you know, Wendy, you called out, will need to be seen on a case-to-case basis. In one case that we had sampled for a tax-equalized assignee going from India to the U.S., annual salary again, $80,000 or so, and moving expenses of about $15,000, the total tax was actually increasing by about $900 as compared to the pre-reform tax regime. And if that cost was to be met by the company, the gross up would make the tax cost even higher. So just wanted to call out an India outbound perspective as well. Rekha, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I think cost modeling and is so important if you really want to understand the impact of it, because each program is different, the mix of assignees is different, their income levels are different. So yeah, so having that and at least understanding and doing some check in terms of what's the impact and how in your role how you can help your business partners understand the impact, I think will make a big difference in the company. And we have some great tools that we are helping clients with in modeling the cost. So we have the cost modeling tool that we're helping with the client with all these changes, which are incorporated. For example, the state and local and property tax income tax limitation that we have, the mortgage interest and the moving expenses, those are all embedded in the tool, which can help us, run the numbers pretty easily for clients to know what's the impact in the dollar amount, which they can, take back to business units or their leadership in terms of numbers, because, all it comes down to numbers, what it means, what's the overall impact on my program. So you really want to do that.
Yeah, so now what we're going to do is we're going to change gears just a little bit, and we're going to focus a little bit on the payroll and the employer implications, as well as some of the corporate implications. So if we move forward, the first slide that we have here in this section is really, what does all of this mean what do these changes mean from a payroll perspective? And I think, the big thing here is that What it can mean is an impact to the cash flows for the individual. So the way that the U.S. rules are written around from a withholding perspective really references specific tax brackets. So the third tax bracket out of five brackets, something along those lines. It doesn't associate withholding amounts with a percentage. It associates, the rules associate with a specific bracket. So the U.S. has some rules that are called supplemental withholding rules that say that any one-time payment must be withheld at the supplemental rate. So if a payment is less, so when we say one-time payment, that means bonus, that means equity, and those amounts, if they're less than $1 million, are generally withheld at the fourth tax bracket, which currently is 25%. So now if we look at the changes within the tax brackets, instead of being withheld at 25%, these amounts are now only going to be withheld at 22% because that's the new bracket. Now, the way the withholding it does not match the ultimate tax liability. So the amount of withholding is really assessed just based on the fact that it's a one-time payment, but the amount of tax that's actually due on the payment is the same as what would be due on salary or on any other ordinary income. So what does that really mean? Well, what it means is that for a higher income earner, they're now going to be withheld less on the bonus or the one-time payment. So anyone who is in, let's say, you know, financial services or in consulting, where a large makeup of the employee's overall income is based on these one-time payments, so the bonus, the equity, that means that their overall percentage on which they're going to be withheld will be lower than what it has been historically, which means that when they get to the tax return, it's likely that they're going to have a larger amount that needs to be paid to the authorities with the tax return. So the cash flows consideration is what's important to note, because I think that, again, even though the tax liability may be substantially similar, it hurts more when you need to write a bigger check. So it's important to communicate those changes around, especially given that bonus season for folks that are in the United States is typically the February-March timeframe, which is just around the corner, ensuring that that communications are going out to the employees and that they're aware of this change is going to be important. And although, you know, in your role, you may not necessarily be the ones that are driving those communications, it's probably good to be aware if you do have assignees for which you're responsible in the United States, it's probably good to be aware what communications U.S. payroll is issuing, because I would imagine that you may get questions that are coming back, you know, if you are the HR contact. So just an awareness, if nothing else, around this change is important.
Yeah, especially executives.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, from a payroll perspective, that's key. There's some other small benefits that have changed from a payroll perspective. I mean, I think we've already hit on the moving expenses. We can certainly go into qualified bicycle commuting expenses if anyone is really really excited about that. But my guess is that this is going to have an extremely minimal impact to anyone on the phone. So with that, we'll keep moving on. I know that we're a little limited in time. We only have about 15 minutes left to move forward with the rest of our slides, and I'm going to hand it over to my colleague Matthew Pover to take us through some of the corporate and other implications. So Matthew, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Wendy and Rekha. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to join you. I think I'm the only one on the call that actually sat in California right now, so it's the end of the day to me. But hopefully I will remain coherent. So as Wendy mentioned, there were a few kind of reward-focused changes that we wanted to highlight, at least at a high level, both from the employer side in implications that companies should be aware of, especially from a cost perspective. So the first is we talked a lot about the income tax rate, but as everyone may have seen in the headlines and already know, the corporation tax rate was perhaps one of the biggest, almost significant changes, a real drop from 35% down to 21% for all tax years beginning after 2017. And unlike some of the individual changes, many of the corporate tax changes will not sunset after a certain period. So that's obviously a huge benefit for corporations, and we're already seeing the implications of those savings and how they'll be passed on. But it's important to note that, that obviously not all companies are calendar year for their tax, for their kind of financial accounting. And so where there's a rate, where there's a tax year that may end into 2018 that would still be considered 2017 tax year, there will be a kind of a prorated rate used for corporation tax purposes based on kind of the number of days of the company's fiscal year that sit within the 2017 and 2018 calendar years. And this kind of idea of the change in corporation tax rate is important because there's a few things that companies can still be considering around taking advantage of greater corporate tax deductions. It sort of goes without saying that where there's a deduction that can be taken where the 35% rate applied last year, a tax-paying company is going to save a lot more money than, say, taking a corporation tax deduction in the new rate of 21%. So companies are currently reviewing things like their bonus plans, their equity plans, benefit plans, to see what the rules are and what options there may be to fix and create deductions that fall within the year of the higher corporation tax rate. So although we finished the 2017 year and these new rules are in effect, there may still be options available to fix those deductions in prior years and potentially save a lot of money for corporations. If we can move to the next slide. So this change perhaps got the most kind of interest of many of our public clients or potential IPO companies around the U.S. And this is a change to corporate tax deduction relating to senior executives, or commonly referred to as 162M. Under the prior rules, the top executives in a company were basically limited to $1 million each of compensation deduction for the company. So, for example, if you paid them $10 million, let's say in general, only $1 million of that could be deducted and $9 million would be excluded. So quite a big loss for the company if you're a tax-paying company. There were exceptions into the old rules that said if that money over the $1 million was qualifying performance-based compensation, and there were specific rules that had to meet, that could also be deducted. So, for example, if you did performance stock units, they would like qualify, and you would be able to deduct all of that income. Under the new rules, they have eliminated the exception for performance-based compensation. And so now executives going forward truly will be limited to the $1 million deduction for the company on their earnings. This is the public companies. There is some grandfathering rules for contracts in place, so companies are reviewing whether current plans in effect as of November the 2nd can still have the old rules attached. And it's worth saying also that the individuals impacted have changed as well. So it used to be the CEO of the company and the top three employees, the three highest paid employees, I should say. And now it includes the CFO of that company as well. And perhaps most interestingly for non-traditional kind of public companies in the common sense, they broaden the definition of foreign corporations that will be captured. So they're including anyone whose stock is traded by the American Depositary Receipts and entities with a publicly traded debt. And so that caught some people by surprise because those changes weren't expected. And so this limitation will capture potentially more companies. So even non-public companies listed on a regular stock exchange are reviewing whether these new rules apply to them. If we could move to the next point, we'll just shift to just a quick comment around the retirement plan funding. So similar to the first comment I made around this idea that we've now had a significant reduction in corporation tax rates, companies are reviewing for their employee benefit plans and retirement plans whether there is an option to, again, fund additional amounts early into those plans to take advantage of deductions in the higher corporation tax rate year. And so it's just to keep in mind that as well as the bonus payments and the equity payments we talked about earlier, there are other planning opportunities that companies are exploring around their benefit plans to take advantage of the higher deduction for last year, which could generate significant savings. For example, if the company has $100 million of contributions to a pension fund, you know, it's going to be a $35 million deduction last year versus a $21 million deduction this year. If we could move on to the next point. Very briefly here, the next two slides, which we'll just talk at a high level, but for private equity programs, there was a new set of rules introduced that have a new qualified award structure that allows an individual the ability to elect to transfer the tax liability on that qualifying equity award for 5 years from the point that the award vested. So it's yet to be seen how widely applicable this will be. There are a lot of rules attaching kind of how a company can qualify and what a qualifying employee is. There's very specific requirements. But if the employee and the employer do qualify as private companies, then there is this ability to defer tax for 5 years. As many people may know, under current plans, for RSUs and options, you know, tax is typically at vest or at exercise. But this would obviously be quite a change in allowing an employee to defer that for 5 years for federal income tax purposes. It's worth noting that would not apply for Social Security FICA purposes. Those rules would still remain in effect, and FICA would be due, as is the case today. If we can move to the next point, I think it may be one more slide. In terms of equity programs, there's a concept of recharge of costs where you have a U.S.-based company with foreign employees and foreign locations. And just to say kind of at a high level on this point, companies are also exploring, once again, their recharge agreements for employee equity plans. So that's whether one entity will recharge the cost of those awards to another entity, because given the new corporation tax rules in the U.S., it may be advantageous for companies to revisit those rules to take advantage of those changes. If we could move on to the next point, I think we are... There was a change, and I'll make this really briefly because I'm not sure how many people this will relate to on this call, to kind of deductions, very favorable deductions for sole businesses, partnerships, and LLCs and S corporations that can deduct either 20% of qualified business income or kind of half of the W-2 wages allocated to a taxpayer. And in essence, what this is a very generous tax deduction for those kind of entities. And especially given the corporation tax rate is also reduced, that's going to be quite a lot of savings for any of the entities that are set up under those structures. And so companies are reviewing their kind of their kind of setup and seeing how they can optimize their new tax kind of incentive structures to take advantage of those favorable rates. But it is worth noting that U.S. Congress is aware of that perception and the fact that may be abused, that companies businesses may try to restructure themselves just to take advantage of those benefits. And so we wouldn't be surprised if there were further changes made to those rules. And then I think the final point to mention is for companies who pay generous leave when an employee is either kind of away from work for family or medical reasons of up to 12 weeks, there's a new tax credit, so another advantage for employers in the U.S., available only for 2018 and 2019 as an incentive for making those payments to the employees. So companies are evaluating whether they qualify for those tax credits, and maybe if they don't, maybe they don't pay quite as much to their employees when they're on leave, reviewing whether or not it may make sense to adjust those policies so that the company can benefit from the tax credits available, because they are between 12.5% and 25% of the wages paid to a qualifying employee in question. And so those can be quite material amounts if you have a lot of people on medical or family leave throughout the year. Okay, I think with that, I'm going to pass back to Wendy, I think.
To Wendy, yeah.
Yeah.
Great, thank you so much, Matthew, for your help. So, I recognize that we're right here up against the hour, and just want to bring this sort of to conclusion and recap a bit. I mean, obviously, you can see that there's a lot of moving parts to the U.S. reforms, and I can fully appreciate that maybe not all of them are entirely applicable to the group on the phone. But I think, the high-level key takeaways are really around, look at from a mobility program perspective, modeling, how does this really impact your program based on the assignee profile? What does this mean for your tax equalization policy, if anything? Is it impacted? And saying, what changes to payroll around moving expenses and anticipating those additional costs might need to be put into place to be sure that you're making all of your stakeholders appropriately aware. And then coordinating with your corporate tax folks to understand if there is any corporate planning aspect that will have a downstream impact on your mobility program or your benefits programs or other HR aspects that would affect your assignee population. And then finally, once you've kind of evaluated all of those different pieces, ensuring that you're communicating effectively to your employees any change that may potentially impact them to help minimize the noise within the system and any blowback or any questions that may come from the assignee population. So with that, I think that's what we have. Tapati, I'll pass back to you.
Thanks, Wendy. That brings us to the end of this discussion. Unfortunately, we're out of time and unable to take any questions on the session. However, if anyone has questions, please feel free to reach out to us, and we'll reply to you in due course. Thank you, Wendy, Matthew, Rekha, for your insights, which you've given us with such clarity on the U.S. tax reform and the impact on global mobility. Thank you all for your participation today, and wish you a great day ahead.
Thank you, everybody. It was nice to chat with you.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, with this, we conclude today's conference call. On behalf of Deloitte, we thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your line.